Hi, welcome to Motorcycle Views with me, Dave Marsden, here on Fab Radio International, brought to you by Z-Power, Kawasaki parts specialist. This show is all about news, views, information and anything else going on in the motorcycle world. We'll have guests, tips, travelling advice and reviews on anything motorcycle related. You can email us at motorcycleviews@yahoo.com. I'm joined also by my wonderful producer, Michelle. So let's get on with the show.
Okay, show 10. On this week's show, we've got a bit of a rant with station manager here at Fab Radio, Paul Ripley, and also with Steve Berry. The three of us will be having a chat or a rant. We've got a test on the on-the-go wing, that's the new 2020 1800. We've got some question and answers. We've got a top 10 and a quick chat with biker Kev Johnson. But first, let's get on with a bit of news. Electric bikes. Well, it would appear electric bikes are not as green as you think they are. Apparently, because of the emissions from production of the bikes, that it takes at least 45,000 miles before they become green, before they break even. Most bikes will probably never reach 45,000 miles, so that's a bit of a strange one, isn't it? In more news, established dealer Three Cross Motorcycles in Dorset have closed the doors after 42 years. They're blaming COVID-19, of course. I think we'll see a few more big dealers disappear before it's all over. MotoGP. Dorna are hoping to start the series in July, late July that is, and they hope to run 10 to 12 races by the end of November, and with no spectators. That'll look strange, won't it? Although some race meetings at some of the locations don't have many spectators anyway. They're hoping to start in Jerez in Spain at the end of July. Apparently Dorna have ordered 10,000 COVID tests for the teams. Also, more bad news, Classic TT in the Isle of Man. That's been cancelled as well. I think that was going to be the end of August and September. So that's another one off the calendar. Now, London's Met Police have reported a massive increase of speeding in London since the lockdown. In some cases, this was an eightfold increase, up from 268 to 2020 in the same week from a year ago. Oh heck, that's a lot of speeding. People are obviously bored. Okay, so let's get on with the show. First up is our road test on the Honda Goldwing 1800. Honda's Goldwing can trace its roots way back to 1975. Back then it was just a 1000cc four-cylinder. Although it was still a game-changer. Water-cooled, shaft drive. It was a naked bike then, of course, as well. It was just another naked bike. However, over time, Honda turned it into, first of all, an 1100, still a four-cylinder, and then a 1500, and it went to six-cylinders, and then to an 1800, still six-cylinders, of course. It became synonymous with touring. It had everything on it, or everything that was fashionable at the time. Now, way back in 2010, I got my first Honda Goldwing, which was an 1800. And, yeah, it was good. Bit too big for this country, of course. So when we started touring America, we originally used Harley-Davidsons. But then we moved on to Goldwings. And then we spent 7 or 8 years, at least twice a year, touring America on the Goldwings. I love them. So when the new model came out in 2018, I was keen to get my hands on one. So the old model had stayed more or less the same for all those years. They did keep doing little updates on it. But it was getting a bit... how should we say, outclassed by other machines, especially BMWs. It wasn't enough anymore to just have that beautiful, smooth six-cylinder engine. BMW had already brought a six-cylinder bike out as well, of course. So Honda had to up the ante. So the new model gained things like an electric screen, satellite navigation, electronic suspension, although the old model had electronic suspension as well, but moved a bit more upmarket. Let's do a bit of spec on the new model. It's six-cylinders, of course. It's now 1,833cc. It's got 125 brake horsepower, which is quite a big increase over the old model. It's got four valves per cylinder. It's got 125 foot-pound of torque, six-speed shaft drive, hydraulic clutch, It's got that weird and wonderful double wishbone front end. It's got the usual electronics, ABS, dual combined braking system, fuel injection, LED lights, traction control, cruise control. It's got four power modes. It's got reverse gear. The old models have reverse gear as well. 18-inch front wheel and a 16-inch rear wheel. Got a 21-litre tank, which is actually smaller than the old model, but Honda claim fuel economy is better on the new model, so you don't need as much bigger tank. Keyless ignition. Seat height 744mm, which is relatively low. It's got a 7-inch TFT screen with the usual Bluetooth and everything built in. It weighs an enormous 365 kilos, but it's still lots lighter than the old model. It's got that built-in sat-nav, which we'll talk about later. It's got the electric screen. And it's also available with the Honda's automatic gearbox, the DCT. But on this one, it's a 7-speed DCT. Comes in a few colours, depending on what year. Red, black and blue mainly in this country. And Honda claims somewhere around 51 miles to the gallon. So what's it like to ride? As I said before, I've ridden many, many miles, probably 30, 40,000 miles on Honda Goldwings, mainly around America, but I have used them in this country. And yeah, they're big and they're a bit cumbersome, but you get used to them and you can actually throw them around. They handle a lot better than what people might think. But the new model, chalk and cheese. It's smaller, it's sleeker, it's neater. Honda seems to have gone away from bigger is best, and this bike actually feels like a bike. That's a cruel thing to say, I know, but it actually feels more like a motorcycle than the old Goldwing did, which apparently has turned a lot of new customers off. They don't want the smaller panniers because they're down 40 litres on the claim that people who use Goldwings don't use them for a long period of time, only for short journeys. I mean, that's just an excuse. They've just obviously messed up there. Smaller panniers just doesn't make sense. Anyway, what's it like to ride? Like I said, it's completely different to the old model. You can actually throw this around and it feels just like, I've said that once, I'm a normal bike, but you'd have to ride the two together to appreciate the difference. The brakes on it are incredible. Probably the best brakes that I've used on any motorcycle. They're just superb. Now, it's got four power modes. The top mode is sports mode. Tour mode, which is what they call normal city cruising, is okay, but you can actually tell the difference. A lot of bikes, I can't tell the difference between the power modes, but on the Goldwing, you certainly can, especially in sports mode. The engine note changes, just everything feels more dynamic. Now, on the claim, the top speed is about 125 miles an hour, which I'll vouch for that. Not on our roads, of course, but I'll vouch for that. And to be honest, 51 miles to the gallon might be a bit optimistic. I found more like 40 to the gallon, but maybe I was just riding it too hard. Now, I was fortunate enough to be given a 1800 Goldwing 2019 model by my good friend John Brown at Hunt's Motorcycles. He let me have a long-term test on it. Now, a long-term test to me isn't just round the corner and round the block and down the main road and up the motorway. So I took it upon myself to take it on a much longer journey. We actually went to Greece for 2.5 weeks, so I got a good test of it. So yes, the fuel consumption I can vouch was around about 40 miles to the gallon. The top speed I can probably vouch for. Now, like I said, it handles a lot better than the old bike. It's still heavy, but nowhere near the heaviness of the old bike. I was two up with Michelle, of course, and she thought it was perhaps not as comfortable as the old model, but she still thought it was the second most comfortable bike she'd ridden after the original model. But then again, she did think the BMW K1600 GT we had for a while was probably as comfortable as well on the pillion. But from a riding point of view, yeah, the Goldwing any day. Now, as I said about the handling, it was fine, but I did notice after about 4,500 miles and the tyres had worn that the handling did go off a little. But 4,500 miles on a set of tyres is about average for me, so that could be just a good sign that get the tyres changed. Now, acceleration. The old model wasn't, well, it's not the sort of bike you want to accelerate fast anyway, normally, especially if you're using it in places like America. But the new model, especially in the sports mode, acceleration is quite good. There's no need to change gears to pass any other vehicle. It's had enough oomph. Now, the engine, of course, that six-cylinder is super smooth. In any gear, at any speed, it feels like a magic carpet. Although when you do take it to the higher rev range, it does, I wouldn't say vibrate, but you can certainly feel the difference in the engine. But never at any time did it feel uncomfortable. It's a superb touring bike. And because it's now lighter and more nimble, it's probably a good all-round bike, which brings you to the price. The one I was on was the Gullwing Tour, which had the top box and all the other parts on it. £27,899. Now, that's a lot of money. If you go for the full top-of-the-range one, it's like nearly £30,000, the one with the DCT. So it's a lot of money. It's not the sort of money you spend on a commuter bike, but certainly if you're planning any sort of trips in the UK or eventually abroad, then, yeah, it's a superb bike for that. Wind protection is great. Rain protection is great. It's good. The electric screen will go quite high, and on the tour model, it's got a higher screen anyway, and it will go quite low. I found it just okay in the middle. And at 6'3", that's unusual for me. I usually have the screen quite high, but it was very good. Unlike the old bike, which I think had about 50 different buttons, it was just button overkill. Honda have really simplified things on this new model. It's still reasonably difficult to work, but nothing like buttons all over the place. So yes, they've improved that tremendously. Now the sat nav, I think I can honestly say that sat nav is the worst sat nav I've ever used on anything, any car or any bike. It was crazy. I know it's their first attempt. I'm not even quite sure who makes it, but it was bad. You put something in as a destination, you turn the ignition off, turned it on, and it just lost it all completely. For that sort of money, Honda, you need to sort that sat nav out. There is actually updates for the American version, but I never found any updates for the English one. But yeah, it was crazy silly. And it's not touchscreen, of course, so you're relying on buttons and levers and paddles to change anything that you wanted to do. It was just a poor show. Honda's not going to impress anybody with that. So what about the bad bits? Well, the sat nav, like I said. And to be honest, this 7-inch clocks, even though they're nice and bright, they wasted. Some of the screens just had one piece of information on it. It looks as though they could have like put some more information on there, and they haven't. Not very good at all, really. The smaller panniers and smaller top box, yeah, it makes it look neater and sleeker, but most Gullwing owners would like a lot more carrying capacity. Not much more to complain about, really. The double wishbone front end is a weird setup. When you're riding the bike, the top of the forks bob up and down in front of you. And at first, it's very, disconcerting. You're looking at it rather than looking at the road or your clocks. But you get used to it after a while, and then it just becomes a blur in front of you. But it is weird. If you're not sure what I'm talking about, just sit on one in a showroom and just move it around. You see them coming up and down and at speed. It's a bit off-putting at first, but I suppose that's just how they have to be. So it might be heavy, but there's certain things about it which have been well thought out. It's easy to put on the centre stand. It pushes around really well, unlike some heavier bikes that I've tested recently. So Honda have got it right in some places, and in some places they haven't. But I think the take-up initially of sales was pretty slow. I would imagine most Gullwing owners, probably were the ones that Honda was obviously trying to sell them to, must have took a ride on one and thought, whoa, apart from being smaller and less carrying capacity, it's a lot sort of faster. And as a good friend of mine who ran a BMW dealership for many years, when the K1600 BMW came out, he said that was targeted at Gullwing owners, but once they've ridden the K1600, they were scared to death. It was like twice as fast, and that's not to say that all Gullwing riders are slow, but a fast bike is not always what they're looking for. So would I buy one? Well, after that long-term test, I must admit I was half tempted to just go and buy one, but as reality sets in afterwards and you think, it's good for a trip to Greece and back, but you know, a normal British roads, it's just a bit over the top, and the price is just stupid, really. But I'd just like to say a big thanks to John Brown at Hunt's Motorcycles in Manchester, Honda's premier dealer, for the loan of the bike.
This is Fab Radio International.
Okay, I'm here today with a good friend of mine, the station manager, Paul, and another good friend of mine, Steve Berry. And we're going to have a little chat, and what we're going to talk about is... what's up with car drivers?
What's up with car drivers, Dave? I'll tell you what's up with car drivers. Unlike back in the day, a lot of people get in a car as their first means of transport, i.e. they haven't ridden a bicycle for 10 years, they haven't used a skateboard, they haven't ridden a motorcycle like people used to do back in the day. And so, because modern cars are so safe, they think they're indestructible, they drive like they're indestructible, and they're always crashing. That's the problem.
And you, Paul, what do you think?
My thoughts are that everyone, every single person at age 16 should ride a motorbike.
Or a scooter. How long for? Like national service, but on a motorbike.
Yeah, so you understand the road conditions, because that's how you understand roads and the weather. And, you know, signage, because you've got to follow it. Stripes in the road, you're scared, and all that type of stuff.
Well, that was good, because, I mean, if you went back to the 80s and you went to France, the roads were so good because everybody in France started on a mobilette when they were 14. So by the time they actually progressed into a car, they were competent motorcyclists, and so they give you the respect when you was on the road. But, of course, I think that died a death. You don't see as many now.
Well, I went to Milan in the 80s. I went to Italy in the 80s for the first time. I won't tell the pair of you why, because you'll hate me. I went to my classic scooter parts.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, but if you're going to buy classic scooter parts... See, the thing was, I was buying them in the UK.
Barry, I hate you.
Why?
I just do. I remember being a kid, and I was on my motorbike, sell scooters. It's not the days of rockers and mods. We want to kick them off, but you thought, nah, forget it. It's like BMW bikes.
Yeah, but Steve watched Quadrophenia.
Yeah, I watched Quadrophenia, and I went to see... Right, and my first gig ever, my first live music gig was... I bet it was Thin Lizzy with you, wasn't it, Dave?
No, my first live gig was actually
Deep Purple.
Pink Floyd.
Pink Floyd?
1971.
Right, well, that says... What about you, Paul?
First live gig?
Yeah.
Leo Sayer.
So, are you willing to admit
with me? Yeah, even worse, it was with me.
Right, so Pink Floyd, Leo Sayer. My first gig was at Manchester University on the Inner City Tour, The Jam. And they were just way cooler than anyone else that was around at the time. Then Quadrophenia came along and I thought, I'd started on bikes. And then I thought, no, I'm going to get a scooter because they're cool. And yeah, they don't ride well, but they are, the Italian ones are cool. So I went to Italy to find parts, because you couldn't get parts. And I'm with my mate in Milan, and I couldn't believe the traffic. And I said to him, it makes you wonder why they don't crash all the time. And he said, give it a minute. And I swear, within a minute, I'll never forget this. This bloke came barreling through this T-junction on this big Kajiva off-road bike, like a 350 Kajiva, two up, walloped straight into a Fiat taxi. That kind of puts paid a bit to our argument, doesn't it? Because in that culture, in Italy at that time, everyone, men, women, dogs, cats, brought up riding bicycles, scooters, motorbikes.
Yeah,
but still, appalling drivers.
No, you still get the exception to the rule, don't you? But I'm talking about generalising here. Generalising. People.
Don't you think that when we're in cars... we probably are the same. I mean, we drive cars and we ride bikes. So maybe it's us that are at fault. Once we put our helmet on, perhaps we turn into a different animal.
No. Because I think, like Paul said, you're much more situationally aware. I've never, in 35 years of driving, instigated an accident that involved another person. I've had single vehicle incidents when I was younger, obviously, but I've never knocked anyone off. I've never run in anybody. But it's countless the
awareness,
number of times.
Awareness. I'm the same with you, Steve. Never had a crash involving another vehicle. I've had mishaps like you. But you're aware. I think you're more aware of the road. You're looking ahead more than a normal driver in a car.
But here's the thing. When you were, like, we're all of a similar age, so we're brought up on, like, American sitcoms like Mork and Mindy and Happy Days and Welcome Back, Cotter and all that sort of stuff.
And Welcome Back who?
Welcome Back, Cotter. You don't remember? It was John Travolta's first thing.
No.
He was in high school in Brooklyn.
No, different TV.
Judd Hirsch was the teacher, the guy at a taxi. Come on. Anyway, right, my point being...
Nanu.
They'd mention driver's ed, and you thought, what's driver's ed? They taught driving at school. Why didn't we... Right, here's the thing.
I did.
When we were doing algebra, why weren't we being taught how to apply for a mortgage? When we were doing trigonometry, why weren't we being taught how to ride a motorbike or how to drive a car?
They had car driving at my school.
You're joking?
No.
What school? Where did you go to school?
The same one as me.
Yeah.
And they taught driving at school?
Yeah. They didn't teach anything else, just driving. That was
it. That if you were a bit thick, you had some driving.
Oh, right. Like they used to send lads to do metalwork and woodwork.
Yeah.
I went to the grammar school, and it was like the ones who were... Can you tell? The ones who were particularly shy and got sent off to do metalwork, which was mega. I only did it for one term, and I sort of thought I was stuck in a classroom doing physics or something like that.
Hang on, I did woodwork and metalwork.
Same, yeah.
Are you now telling me that's why? Because I was stupid.
Well, hold on a second. Maybe that's why you've ended up with one of the, like, best-known motorcycle businesses
good point, Steve,
of the UK.
Good point.
Because while I was in a room doing trigonometry, you were learning how to turn metal and how to... Basically, the lads in our school, guess what they did in metalwork? Come on, what do you... Right, the 14, 15-year-olds, guess what they made? Knives, obviously. Of course they made knives. Oh. If you're a 14 or 15-year-old lad and you set loose in a room full of lathes and milling machines and drilling machines, you're going to make knives, aren't you?
I didn't make a knife.
I was going to say a cake cutter. I think we made cake cutters, didn't we?
Yeah. I didn't make a knife. I think that school you went to, this allegedly grammar school, is a bit different than
it
normal,
was
perhaps.
The grammar school. Right, here's the problem with cars as well. I'll ask both of you this. Do you think those cars have got quieter inside, they become more dangerous to everybody else?
Yes.
Have either of you been in a Tesla?
Yes.
Right. Well, one thing... Have you, Paul?
No.
Well, or a Leaf, or any fully electric...
I've never...
car.
I've been in a... Yes. Right. Something similar.
There's far less soundproofing because you haven't really got the noise of the engine. And as a consequence, when you're driving one, you're more aware of what's going on. You can hear humans talking. You can hear, like, maybe a sort of a bicycle being sort of pedalled along or coming. You're much more aware in electric cars, and I think electric cars will be safer than internal combustion engine cars because I don't think people realise how much they're insulated from the outside world in a modern car.
Let's get real about this. It won't be at all, because inside the car, you've got your radio, you've got your CD player and all the rest of it, and turn up full up, you don't notice. That's what type of driver we're talking about.
Dave, have you ever worn a helmet that had, like, built-in speakers or an intercom or stuff
all
like that?
All the time, yeah. Yeah, me and Michelle use them all the time.
Right. But do you play music in it?
No, I don't, and I don't listen to the sat-nav through them either, because when I'm on a bike, I like the quietness, and that's part of motorcycling, I think. But I have to, obviously, if Michelle's on the back, I feel obliged to talk to her, but, no, I like the solitude of motorcycling.
I had this bloke about 15 years ago who, they were called bass bins or something like
just
that.
Obliged to talk to her. That's just...
Obliged.
Obliged.
That was a polite way of saying she never shuts up.
The point being that this bloke, and obviously I want to know what you two think, he was trying to get me to advertise this service where they took your helmet and they built speakers like tweeters and bass speakers into your crash helmet so you could listen to music while you were going along. And he went, oh, it works up to like 50 mile an hour, and I went, the last thing I want in my crash helmet is that.
Yeah.
But it's what you're saying, Paul, playing the radio, and what you were saying, Dave, playing the radio, making phone calls, that's the problem with a modern car. It's almost as if the thing is designed to...
Like an office.
Exactly, Paul, to distract the driver as much. And if you're saying, what's the problem with cars? They're not cars anymore. They're like an office or your living room. That's the problem.
One of the things that I want to talk about is I think the days of biking are over in many ways. And it's sad, real sad by saying it, but I do. I think it's moved into this world of people who've got a few quid and a certain age who are driving bikes. And that upsets me. And I just want to run it by you. Do you think you'll ever come back how it was when we were kids?
Well, funny enough, I did an interview yesterday with a friend of mine who's started motorcycling when he was 21, which was only 10 years ago. And I was trying to get the angle off him of why a young person... is into motorcycles. And he actually admitted, he said, I can't believe it myself, he said, because none of my friends are interested in motorcycles. So, I mean, that really sets the road to oblivion for a motorcyclist. Who else is going to take over once we've gone?
Well, I think that's a very, very true of this country, Dave, but I think if you look at sales, countries like India, Malaysia, Indonesia, they are developing world countries, Brazil, where almost every young man is first experience, mainly young men, because, you know, that's the way it is in that society. They're having their industrial revolution now. We had it in this city 150 years ago. They're having it right now. And in the same way that my dad in the 50s and all his mates would have had the same conversation about our generation, they would have sat around. My dad's 83 now. He started riding motorcycles as soon as he could reach the handlebars. And his generation, almost every young man would have ridden a motorcycle. By the time it got to us lot in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, I reckon in my class at school, it was about 40% of us, 45%. and my dad's generation would have said, what's wrong with young people? They're not riding motorbikes.
Yeah, so
now we're saying the same thing.
That's just through necessity. It's not through desire, is it?
Well, no, Dave, because, I think you're right, because if you look at, in a way, because if you look at early sort of British kitchen sink dramas of the late 50s and 60s, they're a real giveaway, those films, because they show ordinary British people for the first time. Films had tended to be very sort of highfalutin, just sort of posh people. In the 50s and 60s, there was a revolution. You know, things like Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, Salford's Finest, Albert Finney, people like that, Tom Courtney, portraying ordinary people. And the protagonists in these films always had a scooter or a motorbike, or, if they were married men, a motorbike and sidecar. They'd show these streets in Newcastle or Nottingham or Manchester or Salford. There'd be like one motor car on the street because there was only one person that could afford a car. But we were lucky, weren't we? We had BSA, we had Triumph, we had Norton, we had Velocet, we had Royal Enfield, and they all made fast, affordable motorbikes.
And that's key to it as well, affordable motorbikes. I think if bike prices were lower, a lot lower, then the people would go back onto the road.
We've had that conversation before.
I know we have. I know. However, I'm sticking to it as well.
It's people like him.
Well,
with these Fabergé egg of a motorcycle, absolutely perfect minters that people are afraid to ride, Dave Marsden. They just want to look at them.
Well, I wish you would ride them, we'd sell more parts.
Well, what's happening now, though, is kids are on the streets on scooters, you know, the scooter lot.
Yeah.
Around and cheap motorbikes as well, the Chinese ones, and they're doing all the type of stuff like the robberies and
that's the problem.
Wooden show. So, but it's the thing of they're affordable because they're cheap. Now, if it were past the 125 mark and it's more affordable, perhaps people would use them more.
Here's the problem: you get your Lexmoto and all this, the Chinese, whatever they want to call them, it's essentially the same motorcycles with a different badge on, coming into the UK and into Europe. And this is going to be controversial, but it's kind of true. It's not decent, honest working lads like we were back in the day that are riding under 125cc.
No.
Almost everybody in this city that rides a motorcycle under 125cc is a scumbag. And when you... It's true, isn't
it? You can't say that, Steve.
Dave, it's true. Back in the day when you saw two lads, two up, on a 125 with L plates...
Or a delivery driver.
Yeah, you just thought, oh, yeah. Well, let's leave them out of it because they're just using that as a tool for work. It's different. But back in the day, if you saw two lads, two up on a scooter or a motorbike, you thought, those two mates going to wherever. Now you think, criminal. Yep. You put your phone away because it invariably... It is. Unfortunately, it's become a sign of a wrong un, and a lot of people are turning against motorbikes because of
it. For that reason, yeah. I agree with you, totally agree with you. Dave?
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, obviously, I don't live in Manchester city centre, and I've not been in that often, but the few times I have been in, the first time I came to this radio station, we witnessed a theft of a bike just outside here, didn't we?
Yeah.
And that was that's an eye-opener. And nobody even looked. It was just, there goes another one. So, yeah, it is disappointing, and it is giving people the wrong idea. But
so what can be done to change this, do you think?
We can't do anything. We can't change society. And we can't make people like the thing that we like. It's like, I remember my dad, great bloke, fantastic guy, probably responsible for stoking my interest in both cars and particularly motorbikes. He had a Commando. He came on one night when I was 10 on an RD400 and it just blew my mind. I thought that was it for life. But I remember my dad watching So It Goes on Granada Television. We were all sat around watching the telly. And for some reason, they used to let Tony Wilson have that show after the news. Bizarre. Why did they let him have it? And he used to put bands like Joy Division and bands like that on. And we were watching it. I think it was Joy Division. And my dad was like, what the hell's this? Who are these? He can't sing. He can't carry a bloody tune in a bucket. And I thought, I don't ever want to be that guy. Because my dad was a rocker and a teddy boy on a Triumph. He got banned for fighting from the Palais de Dance. He had a flick knife. It's not like he was some, like, straight bloke who just, was training to be a chartered accountant. He was a ruffian. He was a bit of a Jack the Lad. And there he was, condemning the next generation for doing their thing. So I'm not going to say to these my son's generation. Oh, you're rubbish. You know, your music's rubbish. Your clothes are rubbish. And you don't like motorbikes. If they don't like motorbikes, they don't like motorbikes. And there's no point in us telling them to like them.
No, you're missing the point, though, Steve. It's not affordable for them, it's number one. Most people who are motorbikes, like you just said before, when they're younger, they're, you know, scumbags, they're going to go around on scooters and small motorbikes. How about have that great, you know, I think they've improved how you take a test on a motorbike, because in the past it was rubbish. That's cool, but make the ones that are above 125 affordable. Affordable.
We've had this conversation many times. Me and Steve actually think bikes are reasonably cheap, don't we?
I think they
are. You two are two posh blokes, though.
Yeah.
I'm the bloke in the street.
Yeah, but... You're right in a way, Paul, because up to 125, you've got a myriad of Chinese bikes to choose from. And I'm not going to sit here and slag them all off. Some of them are really well made. They're like everything that comes out of China. It's either built to a price and it's rubbish, or it's like your iPhone and you can't believe, or the latest, whatever phone you've got, you can't believe how slick and beautifully made it is. Some of the most beautifully made stuff in the world comes out of China. It's just more expensive than the other stuff. And some of the bikes, like the Heralds, I really like them. They've got their act together. I look at them, they do all sorts of retro-style bikes, and I think, yeah, they're really nice. But the problem is, when they want to step up to a European motorcycle or a Japanese motorcycle, it's a big step up. Not like back in the day when you had Honda 125, Suzuki 250, and then when you went up to a 750, probably back in the day you would, rather than a 600 or 500, because they were tending to be for commuters, you wanted a 750.
Yep.
It wasn't that massive a step up. And the dealer network was there to say, OK, right, you're done with your 250, you're done with your 125, don't worry, we'll trade that in for you. You can sign on the dotted line here, get your mum or your dad to sign there, and off you go with your 750. One of the things that's a problem is that that dealer network selling the big bikes, nowadays, when I go in, if I go in a Ducati dealer, a Triumph dealer, I rarely go in a Japanese bike dealership anymore because they seem to have completely been wiped off the face of the earth. Hunts are still going, aren't they, lads?
Yeah, Hunts are still doing well, a lot now.
Do you know who's in there? Men our age and older. I don't see young men in those places looking for motorbikes. I see whiteheads, white hair or no hair. And that's the problem. But we're almost like people complaining about the death of the music hall or black and white films. You can't stand in the way of progress. And the problem for young people with motorbikes is this. One, they can't be connected when they're on the motorbike. They can't be looking at a screen. Two, the snowflakes, they are the softer than our generation, in the same way we were softer than our dad's generation. And they don't like the fact that in this country, it's cold and it's wet.
Bollocks,
they're soft. No, they are soft. We were softer than our parents' generation. And they're softer than us. They don't like being cold and they don't like being wet. Paul, they've grown up with central heating. When I was a lad, my job in the morning was to go down and light the fire with kindling and rolled up newspaper.
You know your own.
Well, my dad's job. What was my dad's job when he woke up? When he woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning, milk the cows. Can you imagine that? So they called us soft, and we're calling them soft because compared to us...
No, you're calling them soft. I'm not.
They are.
You're on your own with that one, Mister.
They are. Brought up with central eating, they don't know what it's like to be cold.
Now you're sounding like your dad.
It's true.
We've turned into the grumpy old men, haven't we? This is like a TV series here. We're the golden men.
Yeah, but you're looking for reasons. You're saying, why don't they want to ride motorbikes? And I'm giving you perfectly... Plus, here's the other thing, and I understand why, because I'm still active on the road. I ride all year round, still at my age. Ridiculous, really. But roads are more dangerous. There's more traffic. It's more dangerous. It's more dangerous now than it was when I started 35 years
ago. But these people that you're describing now, these snowflakes and whiteheads, I've never heard of that one before, whiteheads. I don't know what that is. I've heard of blackheads. I had loads of them at school.
Go to the NEC and all you see wandering around are thousands of men that are either bald or have white hair. That's all you see.
But the point is that, are you saying that these subhumans are the ones that are driving the car? So we're back to what's up with car drivers is because you've just described them.
Well, yeah. And
can I just dive in here because I know we're running out of time, but actually a big bright light of the future, and the future's electric bikes, and that'll appeal to certain kids at the right price.
Well, I drove that Zero a couple of weeks ago, if you remember, and I was half impressed, but I mean, a range of 70 miles, It's just...
That'll change, though, won't it?
It will change, but not in our lifetime, I don't think.
Well, they're like phones, aren't they, Dave? The range is... Well, no, do you know what? I've damned myself out of my own mouth. I said, they're like phones, the range is going to get better. There was a pivotal moment, wasn't there, about... What would you say it was, about 8 or 10 years ago, when phones went from batteries that lasted for 2 or 3 days to you were struggling to get through the day like we are now.
Yeah.
I remember having... I think it was a Sony Ericsson. I used to plug it in like twice a week, use it quite a lot. And then obviously as phones got smarter and became small computers that we carry around, the battery life went...
And the screen. The screen takes so much battery as well.
Went shocking, didn't it?
OLED screens, etc.
Yeah, I'm not sure about electric... Electric bikes... One of the things about electric bikes and electric bicycles is legislation. At the moment, they are taking the piss. Somebody went past me yesterday on an electric bicycle. He was doing 35 mile an hour, and I thought, no number plate, no helmet, no tax, no insurance. I thought, the government are going to jump on that.
I thought they were restricted to 25 clicks.
Dave, it's like anything else.
You can buy motors now. The place in Salford where you can actually buy the kit, put it on your own bike, and we talk about unrestricted, as, you know, I mean, the range isn't far, but...
Look at the Deliveroo lads. Yeah. They all had mopeds 2 years ago. Yeah. Outside the building I live in, which is an old hotel in Salford, downstairs is a restaurant on the ground floor, and they're doing a lot of Deliveroo. And a couple of years ago, every night there used to be a gaggle of 50cc and 125cc mopeds. Now they're all on electric bicycles. Why? I tell you again, no tax, no insurance, no crash helmet, no MOT. That's a hell of a burden off them. And if I was them, I'd do it. I wouldn't use an internal combustion engine. I'd just use a bicycle. Do me stuff. They're only doing 70 miles, Dave. They can do a whole day's work, a whole shift, and then they just leave it at the restaurant at the back. They're all plugged in a line. But they're going to have to legislate for that because they need that tax money. They need that road tax licence. They need that duty on fuel, the government. So they are going to change it.
Well, they will do soon after this lockdown, won't they? They'll need everything. They will be taxed out of their brains.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, Dave, me and Paul are paupers compared to yourself, so we're not that valid, pal. We're not selling Z9s or Z1000s.
Was that a compliment or an insult?
It's a compliment, Dave.
I never know from you, Steve. I have to go home and think about these things afterwards.
Please,
what did
please,
he say to me?
Please take it as such.
Oh, right. OK, well, I think that's enough for now. We well went off the question there, didn't we? So what was wrong with the car drivers? Did we decide? The car drivers.
There's too many of them, and cars, as Paul pointed out, Paul made the best point, probably spoke the least, but made the best point. Cars aren't cars anymore, they're offices and living rooms, and that means that people slam them into things, including other vehicles, pedestrians, and particularly cyclists and motorcyclists, and that's the problem with car drivers.
Okay, we'll leave it at that, unless you've got anything else to throw into that, Paul.
No, I can't add to it. I think we should do it again, that's all I'd say.
Oh, what, in 5 years' time when electric bikes are...
No, I think we should have a late night, all night, chat shit about bikes and cars. One night.
My God. Actually, it would be good, that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would.
Yeah, we could have get people to ring in as well. That would really up the ante, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and Skype in. And they'll be all green with me and ignoring Mr. Berry and yourself. That's what I'll find.
Yeah, I don't believe that for a second. But thanks anyway, guys.
This is Fab Radio International.
Hi, we now have our question and answer section. Are you right, Dave?
Yes, what's the first question?
Dave Hogan from Surrey. With the development of direct injection two-stroke engines, why do two-strokes not rule the world? The sound of a two-stroke 500 GP bike is much better than a four-stroke. Why can't we go back to the glory days of two-strokes?
That's a good question, Dave, and I'm with you all the way there. You're right, the sound of a two-stroke bike is far superior to the four-stroke. But that's the way it is. Now, I do know that quite a few of the manufacturers are still messing around with two-strokes, and as you say, the direct injection has improved it no end. But if you want to go back far enough, if you remember, way back in the 90s, there was a company in Australia, they were in Perth actually, called Orbital. Now, they developed a small two-stroke engine, which was actually more like a Wankel. It was the combustion chamber was divided by blades. Not quite a Wankel, but just to give you an idea. Now, this was a really good engine. It was light, powerful, clean, and economical. But trouble is, it was a little unreliable. Now, Ford took it on board, and they tried it in one of their small cars. but because of the unreliability, they didn't bother. They bottled out and stuck with the old four-stroke. That never got anywhere. That was going to be a great promise. And then way back in 2015, not that long ago really, Honda released some patents of a direct injection two-stroke engine, which they were going to be using. But again, nothing's happened with that. Now, when the four-strokes took over in MotoGP in 2002, the reason they gave at the time that the two-strokes were too dirty, but I think it was just a marketing thing. I mean, there's been a lot of talk of rebooting the two-stroke in racing, not just in bikes, but in Formula One, using synthetic fuels to reduce emission. It sounds a good idea. But at the moment, they're just too busy with this electric thing, pushing less electric class in MotoGP, the Moto E, I think they call it. Now, it's going to take a brave manufacturer to do it. And the problem is that they say racing is really just to improve road bikes. And I can't see a future for two-stroke road bikes. So why would they bother spending money developing a two-stroke engine? But I'm definitely with you. It would be nice. Hope that answers your question. Have you got another one, Shell?
Yes, I do. Steve from Exeter. I'm desperate to buy a new bike once this lockdown is over. I think I've watched every bike review on YouTube, listen to your bike reviews. Trouble is, the bike I want is nearly 20 grand. So I'm looking at finance. A PCP deal seems to be my best bet. What do you think?
Well, funny enough, I've got a little bit of information on PCP deals. So have you got it there? Shall I read it out to us? But just to explain the basics of it.
Yeah, it says how it works, its title. Agree an initial deposit and term with the dealer and decide how many miles you'll travel each year. The dealer will then work out the monthly repayment and the optional final repayment amount. This is based on the anticipated value of the bike at the end of the agreement. At the end of the agreement, you can part exchange the vehicle, return the vehicle, depending on the returns conditions which will probably apply, or pay the optional final repayment and own the vehicle. The finance company then buys the bike on your behalf and owns it for the duration of the finance agreement. After you've made all the repayments, including the optional final repayment and any interest, you will become the owner of the vehicle. Now, at the end of the agreement, you will have three choices. Part exchange. Subject to paying off your existing agreement in full, you can part exchange the vehicle at the end of the term or any time during the agreement. New credit agreements are subject to status. The vehicle can be worth less than the optional final repayment, leaving you with a shortfall to pay before starting a new agreement, so that's something to consider. Return. You have the option to return the vehicle at the end of your agreement. To avoid incurring charges, the vehicle needs to be in good condition and within the permitted maximum mileage. The third option is own. Own the vehicle outright by paying the optional final repayment. So, Dave, do you want to add anything to this?
Yeah, I can add a bit to that. That's obviously a statement from one of the leading finance companies who specialise in bike finance. Now, there's plenty of things on there that he doesn't tell you. I'll tell you a little bit. I mean, I've bought bikes on PCP. I bought cars on PCP about 30-odd years ago. It's a relatively new thing on bikes. But over 50% of bike sales now are on PCP, so it is a growing thing. Well, the beauty of PCP is that you can have an expensive bike for around about 50% cheaper on the monthly payments than a straight HP deal. That's because you're only paying the depreciation. What happens on a PCP is that they decide how much it's going to be worth at the end of the agreement, like we've said, and you don't pay that. That's what you pay at the end, but they do put the interest charge on that. So you do actually pay a bit more interest, but it still makes it cheaper. So like I said, the beauty of it is that you can get a more expensive bike for less money. Now, normally, the bike has to be no more than 7 years old, so it's generally used on new bikes. Now, PCP is good if you change your bike quite often. PCP deals normally last between 2 to 4 years. Most people take them out for 3 years. But what you've got to remember is that you can part exit at any time. It doesn't really matter. It's just treated then as a normal bike sale. And the other thing people get sucked into is the mileage charge. They might say to you how many miles you do, and you'll say 10,000 miles. So you're charged accordingly, but you might only do 4,000 miles. So it's well worth just putting the lowest mileage possible down. And at the end of the agreement, they will charge you the extra mileage, but you're better paying for it at the end than up front, because if you don't use it, they're not going to give you any money back. Always go for the smallest amount of miles. Now, Also, the APR can change on PCP deals, which can make things a lot different. And of course, some manufacturers, like Honda especially, they do bikes on 0% APR PCP deals, so that makes it a lot cheaper. So always still check the APR. Now, that optional final payment is the residual value of a bike. That can make things different on a lot of different models. For instance, a bike that doesn't depreciate a lot, like a BMW or a Harley Davidson, can prove to work out cheaper than a similar Japanese bike. Not knocking Japanese bikes, but they do tend to depreciate more. So you might find that you can afford an even better bike. I do know someone who bought a Ducati for the same price as buying a Honda £5,000 cheaper. So that's also something else to consider. So having said all that, yeah, a PCP deal is a good thing to do. It doesn't suit everyone, and I have heard people say, yes, but I'll never own the bike. And at the end of the day, do you really want to own the bike? Most people these days don't want to own the vehicle. That's why leasing's so popular in the car world. So take everything into consideration, but yeah, don't be put off by it. Any more questions, Shell?
No, that's it, Dave.
Okay, have you got a quiz for this week?
Oh, yes, so I have. And the quiz question is, what year was the 50cc class introduced into Grand Prix racing? I'll tell you later.
Those hands are playing the strangest musical instrument in the world. The only instrument that is not touched by hands. You ask for it.
Right, today I'm here with another good friend of mine, Kev Johnson. Welcome to the show, Kev.
Thanks, Dave. Really, really good to see you.
It's good to see you as well, and happy birthday again.
Well, yeah, we've turned over the big six, so it was a bit of a quiet one in the COVID, but there we go.
Right, Kev, I'm going to go back to the 90s. Do you remember that far back?
Lordy, lordy. Yeah, I can just about remember that, yeah.
Right, well, the first thing that springs to mind when I think of you is you were the first person I know with a big adventure bike.
Well, it was in 1990, I had a Honda VFR 750, and I loved the thing, loved the bike, went everywhere. But I always had a penchant, a real fancy for a big trail bike. And when Triumph brought the first Tiger out, I was just completely gobsmacked. It had the 900 triple engine in, which was a gem. When I had a Gorm one, that was it. I was just in love.
But we were all on ZZR 1100s and Fireblades, and we all thought, what the hell is he playing at on a big trail bike like that? Even though I'd had plenty of trail bikes, but small ones, we realised you were a trendsetter.
Well, I'm glad to think you think I was a trendsetter. But at the time, all the bikes I liked were big sit-up bikes, big. Well, as we are today with BMWs and everything else. The ZZRs were fabulous, very, very quick, lovely bikes, but I just preferred the more sat-up riding position.
Okay, so what was your first bike?
My very first bike was, it was actually an FS1E, but it was the SS, the 16er Special, which obviously they had to drop the moniker because of Honda. And I just remember the feeling the day before I got the bike. I could have been in love with the most beautiful woman in the world. I just couldn't wait to get to the shop to pick it up. I don't think young lads nowadays ever get that feeling, but it was just so memorable that I got on my bike and I was actually there on my bike.
So presumably you only had that for 1 year before you moved up to the 250?
Yeah, well, I didn't quite make the year because I had a bit of an accident on it. And then I had a little period away, just a few months away. And I actually played about with a lot of little bikes before I got a 250. I ended up with TS100s, Honda 125s, basically go-to-work bikes. And I had a whole string of 125s. I had more 125 engines in my garage than the Honda shop did, the local Honda shop. But it was transport to work until I bought a DT175. And at that point, I realised I want to go trail riding.
So that was trail riding on-road or off-road?
Well, it was on-road. It gave me the experience of going onto unmade roads. And in those days, all the trails were open. You could go anywhere. And then I rode it. I remember I'd ride it to work and I'd come home. And then I used to race it in a trail bike class at weekend and then clean it up on the Monday night when I got home from work, and fix it up and then carry on. But the DT was my introduction into trail bikes.
So you didn't just ride them. When I first met you, you were also had a garage full of bikes and pieces. So you was what were you doing? Were you fixing them or restoring them?
Well, it was always a love to mend them. It was sort of my trade. I am a fitter by trade, but it was always hankering to get a bike that was in untidy condition, and I thought I could make that a lot nicer. And many years, as you know, we've been doing it now, and I still get as big a kick out of it today as I always did.
I remember once you trying to restore an old 750 twin of mine. Whatever happened to that bike? I can't even remember.
Well, funnily enough, I was just tidying the garage out of during this lockdown, and I pulled out all the paperwork for that, the Z650B, rebuilt the engine, got quite a lot of the other bits and pieces together, and then I think I was interrupted by the birth of my son. And I think at that time, things moved around, so things like that became less important. I don't actually know what happened to it. I think I sold it to one of your customers, because the engine was all ready to go. It just wanted cycle parts on it. But it was a great engine to work on that. Not the best engine in the world. The balance shafts are a pig to get right, but it was a great engine to work on. And they were good. They were actually quite nice to ride, but just not an arm puller. And it wouldn't turn heads like a Z1 would if it just passed you on the street.
Now, in our little group of riders in the 90s, you were always, how can I say this? You were always the clown of the group. And we could always rely on you for a good laugh. In fact, I can't think of a time when you didn't have a big smile on your face. Was that just because of the bikes, or was you just so happy?
I was... well,
or drunk?
Possibly one of the two. I enjoyed a spirited ride, and I just have a great time when I was wearing the bike. It was always great to get away with all the lads. I do have one not a sad memory, it's a memory when we went away. I think we were going to Le Mans, and I just had a helmet painted. Now, you described the helmet, and it was an Arai, and you described it as a busted rabbit. Do you remember that?
I do. It was all sort of bloodstained and looked as though... In fact, again, you was probably a trendsetter, because after that is like the splash design became very, very popular on all Japanese bikes and on the helmets.
It did. It was supposed to be red silk, and when I walked in with it and showed you me, I was very proud of my new helmet, and you said, "Kev, it looks like a busted rabbit." And I said, "Thanks for that, Dave. That's marvellous. I've just spent a fortune." But the sorry part was, I'd put it on the floor when we were filling a bike up, and one of the lads kicked it across the forecourt.
Why? Because it was so pretty?
Purely by accident. I remember dropping the pump and diving for my helmet. And he was so apologetic. I'm sure he won't remember it, but actually, no damage was done. It was all right. But I was so proud of that helmet, and I've actually still got it.
Oh dear, the lining will be like a rat's nest by now.
It's not good. I had a look in it the other day. I was going to bring it up just for you to have a look at, to remind you of the 90s.
Yeah, well, I've got enough memories of the 90s. Now, you've got a few funny stories that you used to tell us, or tell anybody who'd listen. Well, it didn't matter if they wanted to listen, you used to tell them anyway. Now, I remember you buying a bike off out of Motorcycle News, I think. It was a Honda 600 trail bike or something, and you got to the guy who was selling it, and it turned out to be...
Well, it was Steve Parrish. Now, when I rang for the bike, it was just an advert, an ordinary simple advert, as we did in the day, Motorcycle News, there it was. I'll give him a ring. And he answered the phone, Steve Parrish. And I actually said, "What, the Steve Parrish?" He said, "Well, I don't know how many you know, but yes." I said, "Right," I didn't even haggle for the bike. I said, it was a brand new Honda XR 600 to go trail riding enduros on. And he said, "Right, okay, you can have it." I said, "I'll send a deposit." He said, "In those days, I think we sent cheques or something." He said, no. He said, "I know you're going to come for it." And I got one of the lads at work to ring for the bike after. And he said, "No, I'm sorry, it's sold." I thought, what a genuine guy. But the trip down there was something else. Went down to his house. And at the time, he had a lovely place in Hertfordshire. But he had the complete collection of his old bikes and a lot of Barrachine bikes in there. And it was before the days of mobile phones and little cameras. And I could have got picture after picture. But what a really fabulous bloke that is.
Moving on from that, you did quite a bit of work in the Isle of Man, I believe, in the job that you did. And only Kev Johnson could do this. Just tell us, whose doorstep did you end up knocking on?
Well, I was across there, and I knew Norman Wisdom lived on the island, and I was working at a show, actually, and it went quiet one afternoon. So I asked one of the lads where he lived. He said he lives at a place called Ballylough. I said, all right, I'll go and have a look. So I jumped in the car, and off I went, red hot day, beautiful weather, and I got to the village, the house called Ballylough. Went in, I thought, I'm going to just go knock on the door. And his Rolls-Royce was there with NMN on the registration. I thought, well, cheek of the devil. Walked up the drive, knocked on the door, no answer. So I knocked a bit harder. Bit cheeky, really. Anyway, came to the door, and I think I'd woken him up. He looked a bit like he just... Like, anyway, his hair was all over the place. And I said, oh, I'm sorry about this. He said, I just wanted to come and meet you. And you know, what a friendly, lovely guy he was. He gave me a little sign picture, a bit of a chat on the drive about his old films. I said, listen, I'll let you get on. What a really nice guy.
I'm just trying to imagine you and Norman Wisdom together. That would have, yeah. It's a shame we didn't have cameras and things in those days, isn't it? That would have been good. So after that, of course, you continued riding motorcycles. And like the rest of us, you suddenly become an old GS fart, and you ended up on a Boxer Twin.
Yeah, well, it follows a whole line of fundamentally trail bikes. I've had a lot of road bikes as well over the years. I always seem to go back to little two-strokes for some reason. I love little two-strokes. But on the bigger bikes, I've had two GSs, and I think they're the most fabulous bike. You can just do anything with them. We still like to go out for a little bit of a spirited ride. We do a lot of miles, myself and my partner. She loves to go on the back of the bike. We go anywhere we can. Probably not as many miles as you do, Dave. And I know you and your good lady wife really enjoy your travelling about the place. And I'd love to be on some of your trips with you. We could really soak up the atmosphere.
Well, you can always come with us. So what are you doing in this this lockdown period? Are you getting a chance to go out on the bike at all? Or are you just back at home fixing them?
Well, no, we've not been out. Well, I've had to leave the bike alone for a little while. I'm still very busy in the garage. I've got quite a few jobs on with some bikes I'm restoring at the moment. The bike time is obviously limited because we can't make unnecessary journeys. I have a trail bike, a KTM, that I'm itching to get out on again. And we just have to abide by the rules. There's not a lot we can do. And we just have to stay safe and get through all this period.
Well, that's all we've got time for today, Kev. So just like to say thank you and keep it up.
It's been wonderful to go down memory lane. Thanks, Dave, and regards to your producer as well.
Okay, so now we've got this week's top 10. And this week's top 10 is top 10 Grand Prix winners. Or MotoGP, depending on how you look at it. Depends how old you are. At number 10, actually there's a tie for 10th place, we've got Jim Redman. He had 45 wins. And Casey Stoner, also with 45 wins. Now, Jim Redman went on to win 6 world championships. Casey Stoner only went on to win 2. But, you know, if he carried on, if he didn't retire in 2011, he could be up at the top. But that was his choice. At number 9, Phil Reed. 52 wins and 7 world championships. At number 8, Danny Pedrosa. He had 54 wins and won 3 world championships. At number 7, Nick Doohan. Also had 54 wins and 5 world championships. So it should be a tie, really, but it's not. At number 6, Jorge Lorenzo. 68 wins, 5 world championships. At number 5, Mike Aylward. Mike the Bike. 76 wins and 9 world championships. At number 4, Marc Marquez. 82 wins and 8 world championships. That's going to change, of course, because he's not finished yet. Number 3, Angel Nieto, 90 wins and 13 world championships. At number 2, Valentino Rossi, 115 wins and 9 world championships. Again, maybe he's not finished yet, or maybe he has. Who knows? And at number 1, Agostini, 122 wins. That's the goal that Valentino Rossi was aiming for. Aggo won 15 world championships as well. So that's the top 10 Grand Prix winners. But just a little bit of a bonus here. We've got the top 5 countries that have won world championships. At 5, the USA. Surprise me that. They've had 17 world champions. Number 4, Germany. They've had 18 world champions. Number 3, the UK. We've had 45 world champions. Number 2, Spain. Doesn't surprise me. 52 world champions. That'll probably go up. But number one, Italy, of course, with 79 world champions. So that concludes our top 10 Grand Prix winners. By the way, there were three countries that only won one championship. Can you guess what they were? Well, I'll tell you anyway. Finland, Austria and Hungary. They only ever won one world championship each. So, unfortunately, that's the end of the show. Again. Anyway, the answer to that question, when was the 50cc class introduced into MotoGP or Grand Prix? It was 1962. Oh, and the answer to last week's bike sound, it was a Ducati V4. Either a V4S or a V4. Street Fighter or Panigale, didn't really matter. So, thanks for listening. Hope you'll listen again next week. And remember, keep sending in your questions. Until then, goodbye and keep safe.